Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth, best-selling author and co-creator of PaleoParents.com, where we focus on real-life solutions for families seeking health.
I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, New York Times best-selling author and creator of ThePaleoMom.com. I'm passionate about improving scientific literacy around public health topics.
I like hashtags and bone broth.
And I'm just a super nerd.
So I would say we've had three long questions. We should try to
do
rapid fire.
We should do a rapid fire. Is that?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we should do a rapid fire, like everybody's favorite questions.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite color is green.
No, that's not what they...
That might be what they ask. They might want to know.
Okay. Do you guys want to know my favorite color? It's black.
You had a mixed response there.
Because why would they care?
That might be all they came here for. You don't know. You're making assumptions.
What's your follow-up?
Okay, my follow-up. My name is Christine, and I'm pretty sure I heard you say that different autoimmune diseases would have different vitamin and mineral deficiencies. So my question is, how do you find out which one is specific to you?
So it's more that there's this collection of studies that have looked at an autoimmune disease, and they've either measured, you know, vitamin D levels is the classic example, in a group of clients, and how many of them are deficient, and oh look, it's 93% of them, or they have supplemented with a nutrient and shown some kind of improvement in disease markers. But there aren't very many studies that look at collections of nutrients. There's a couple that look at two or three. And there are not very many studies that look at a collection of autoimmune diseases. Like, they might couple inflammatory bowel disease together and look at both Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. They might couple Graves and Hashimoto's together. They might do that. But there aren't these, like, sweeping studies that go, hey, let's look at these 24 autoimmune diseases and then we'll look at these 20 nutrients and we'll start to pick apart. So what there is now is basically this collection of individual studies that you can say, hey, they've looked at, you know, Hashimoto's thyroiditis and shown these, you know, it's iodine, selenium, iron, and zinc, right? Like, there's that, but has anyone gone and said, well, how important is vitamin C in Hashimoto's? No, no one's actually looked. So it's a little bit different than saying certain nutrient deficiencies are tied with certain autoimmune diseases. It's more saying there's incomplete data right now, and we have some data for some nutrients and some autoimmune diseases, but we don't know about the other ones. So what we can say is that there's certain frequent flyers, like vitamin D, like vitamin A, like zinc, omega-3 fats. Those are the most common ones that have been studied and the most common ones to be beneficial with supplementation. You can look at the nutrients that the immune system uses. You see vitamin A, I mean, most of the vitamins, but vitamin A and vitamin D are really key for regulatory actions. Zinc also very, very key for regulatory actions. The immune system uses, because there's some proteins in the immune system that need methylation to be able to control the immune system. So B6, B9, B12. Vitamin C and vitamin E are really key antioxidants, so that's important for immune system function. Iron, copper, magnesium. There's probably one I'm missing because you put me on the spot here. But there's, you know, some key nutrients that have really fundamental roles in the immune system, and it's sort of no surprise when you think of it that way that a deficiency in one of those nutrients would impact how the immune system's functioning. And so then you kind of go, well, like, of course nutrient deficiencies then are linked to diseases that have... I mean, it's not just autoimmune disease. That's why we see nutrient deficiencies linked with cardiovascular disease, because the root of cardiovascular disease is still inflammation, and that's why we see it linked with obesity and diabetes. Like, that's why. It's because the immune system needs those nutrients to work properly. So it's a little bit different than saying, well, hey, I have rheumatoid arthritis, which supplements should I take because deficiency is a problem? I mean, there's a fair amount of science with nutrient, you know, supplements and RA, but it's not like there's this, these great big sweeping studies that have really nailed down all of these links. Makes sense?
Yep.
Yeah.
Do you guys want to ask us questions? And I will challenge Sarah to answer them quickly.
I have a quick question. I think it's quick.
Okay. I'm not usually quick at answering, but that's all right. I'll do my best.
To follow up to the first question about children. And so I have celiac and Hashimoto's. And we've chosen now to make our daughter gluten-free and dairy-free. But how will I ever know if she's going to have celiac if she's not eating gluten? Am I just going to have to suck it up one day and give her gluten for a month and then test her and this one? I don't know, like, I want to maybe reduce the risk of him getting it, so should I give it to him at, like, 6 months, then not give it to him ever again, and then test him later?
So the question is, as a follow-up to the first question that we had, which for podcast world, that's probably an episode or two ago. it's okay. About when to potentially introduce.
When and if.
Or when, if you choose to not introduce it, essentially, like, when would you know if someone did have a gluten intolerance or not? And my answer would be the same as the first answer I had, which is that we just chose to assume, based on family background, that gluten intolerance was a problem, and that we found out what a reaction was based on an exposure. I don't need a piece of paper to tell me whether or not my kids have celiac for me to know that gluten intolerance runs in the family. It's easier for me because my mom has anaphylactic reaction to wheat. So it's like, it's pretty easy to put that in a box and be like, yep, we're not going to do that. You know, like, we don't want to do that. So, but I think if it really is important to you for one reason or another to have that, then you would need to have exposure to do the testing, because there's no way to not be exposed and then, you know, see damage from exposure. It's just doesn't work that way.
I mean, the other thing with your daughter is, you know, chances are very good that at some time in her life, she will rebel and eat all the gluten. And there would be nothing wrong with waiting until that point for her to find out. And she starts eating the gluten and she starts having symptoms of celiac. And then you go, hey, this is why we didn't give you gluten all the time when we had control over what you were eating.
But see, the thing with symptoms of celiac, and I like quotation marks with that, is that it can show in so many different ways in different people. And some people can have celiac with no symptoms at all, like, or no digestive symptoms, right? So now I've improved my gut health. When I accidentally got exposed to gluten, I did not have, like, the violent stomach reaction. I actually had an emotional, depressive kind of reaction, which is what happens to Cole as well. So he says to me, well, I don't have digestive problems when I eat gluten. And I'm like, what, so? Like, you still obviously are reacting. So a piece of paper or a test isn't going to solve the real question, which is, should I eat it or not? And if the answer is you don't do well on it, then the goal is to avoid it, right? Like, pure and simple. Because they can't do anything for you if you have celiac. It's not like once you have a diagnosis, they can solve it. They can't do that. The answer is they're going to tell you to avoid gluten, which you're doing to begin with.
You're right the whole time.
Exactly. Keep doing what you were doing before you reintroduced it to have this test. It just doesn't make a lot of sense for me.
Yeah. And then in terms of the baby, the research that's new that's coming out, they've done it with gluten. They've done it with other allergens, and they show that they've done it with celiac disease and shown that there's a lower risk of celiac disease if gluten is introduced while you're still breastfeeding. And the longer you breastfeed, the lower the risk. I mean, then that's independent of if you ever give them gluten. The longer you breastfeed, the lower the risk. So no pressure, right? None.
Yeah.
So, you know, that, though, is the science, like, super cut and dry, that every single person should be introducing wheat before their kids wean. I think what the science mostly says is the longer you breastfeed, the better. That really is the clearest message. If I had another one, which I'm not, but if I did, would I... This is always... I always, like, turn it around. If it was my situation, I would probably try a little bit of wheat a couple of times, but like I nursed both of my kids until they were just over 2 years old. So I'd probably do it towards the end, you know, like I'd probably do it at 1.5. So I'd wait a good long time so that they maybe even had some ability to communicate how they were feeling. Cause that's also like when a baby's having a reaction, it can be really hard to tell. I mean, still when you're changing diapers, there can be some good signs, but if it's a more of an emotional response or, you know, my oldest over here, who's looking like she's having so much fun, she had stomach aches and she had them every time she ate. And she didn't know that was weird until we went gluten-free when she was 5 years old. And then she told me, Mommy, I like food now because I don't have a tummy ache all the time anymore. Which was just digging in the knife and twisting it, I think. But she didn't know. She had no frame of reference for that. She didn't know that was weird. So with an older child with some language capabilities, if you are able to nurse that long, you've got a little bit more opportunity to isolate any other possible reactions. But it doesn't need to be much. So the studies that did peanut allergies, they were giving, I think it was 2 grams of peanut protein a week. It was sort of the equivalent of like 6 peanuts a week. And that was how much they were giving, and that was reducing the number of peanut allergies later. So it's not like you have to be like, and now we're going to have pasta all the time. It can be like a bite here and there when the opportunity presents itself, and watch to see what happens. And if you do see signs of reaction, like stop. It's not going to help you to keep going.
The other thing to consider is if you're nursing that long, which is what I think happened with Wesley. Like, I know I was exposed to gluten while I was nursing, and that would have been passed through breast milk as well.
Yeah.
So to me, that kind of covered the base, and I didn't feel like I needed to put it in his mouth. But okay, Jessica had a follow-up to the follow-up.
Should I say come back here?
You can come forward, yeah.
Did you say come forward? About the, I don't know what you think of the Entero Lab test, but that was sort of my first testing for gluten sensitivity and malabsorption and celiac and everything. And so when my son was 2, we did the cheek swab DNA test. And so, you know, he clearly has the genetic disposition for celiac. And we had not done any gluten at that time at all, and never have intentionally, with only a few accidents. And so with my second child, we've just said, you know, we have celiac. And so I have sort of one piece of paper that says, I think he would have gone that way. And it's just been, I do, and it's clear my husband, who hasn't done the test, has sensitivity. So it just seems like so, and I, you know, I know that I had the GIGOT stuff with both of them. So I feel like they already came in with, you know, issues clearly. And so to even do a little bit, like, I just wouldn't even go there at all.
So what's really interesting about the celiac susceptibility genes, HLA-DQ2 and HLA-DQ8, is there's been studies done in people without celiac but who also have digestive symptoms, and they've actually shown that they are still getting the zonulin response to gluten. So they're still getting a leaky gut in response to gluten that's just not celiac disease. Now, does that mean every single person with HLA-DQ2 or HLA-DQ8, which is like 60% of the population is one of those two, has the zonulin response? Actually, probably. So that's probably our gluten-sensitive population right there is linked with that genetics. So, you know, I think that having one of those celiac risk genes would be a compelling argument to not mess with gluten because of the possibility of a leaky gut reaction even without developing celiac. That makes sense to me, yeah.
Thanks.
That was me being fast.
I've got a follow-up to the follow-up.
To the follow-up to the follow-up.
This is going to be the follow-up podcast.
Should I come back?
I think you're good. Just speak loudly.
Okay. So there's the Gluten-Free Society website. I don't know if you've ever looked at them, but the doctor that is on there, who is a, you know, big researcher and has this whole practice in celiac disease and gluten sensitivity, he claims that there's actually 2 other genes that are associated with gluten.
gluten sensitivity, and that's the HLA DQ1 and DQ3, which no standard celiac genetic test ever looks for those two. They just look for the 2 and the 8. Do you know if there's anything? That's the only place I've ever seen those two specifically noted, and I haven't been able to yet figure out how or from where he's determined those two are linked to gluten sensitivity.
I have not seen anything.
Really curious about that one.
So I have not seen anything to that effect, but that being said, I've never specifically looked through the millions of articles on PubMed for that. So I've never looked for it, but I've never happened on it. And I've done a lot of looking for, you know, genetic links with gluten sensitivity. I've never seen it. That doesn't mean it's not there. That's just not something that I've looked for.
This is where, if it were a regular podcast, she would be.
Let me look through PubMed right now. But my phone's there, so I can't.
I don't know if it's like a newer thing, maybe, that's been being discovered. I mean, especially with all the genetic research.
I mean,
a lot of it is.
So there is still 3% of celiacs who aren't HLA DQ2 or HLA DQ8.
3%?
Mm-hmm.
Really? I thought it was lower than that. I've read 0.4%, which, again, it depends on your source.
Well, it depends.
Right?
It also depends on the country that these studies are done in,
right,
too,
yeah.
Right? So, you know, what I've seen from meta-analysis is about 97% of celiacs have HLA DQ2 or DQ8. So there's that other 3% that are having that reaction to gluten with a different genetic susceptibility. So, I mean, that could be DQ1, DQ3.
Right, yeah. I mean, I have definitely heard of people who don't have the genes, and yet they're diagnosed celiac. So clearly we don't have a full picture. And the point is it's not that it's not genetic. We just maybe don't have 100% clarity yet, because
no, and there's already more than a dozen HLA variants that are linked with different autoimmune diseases.
Right.
You know, clearly that gene is really important.
Sure.
When you think of what it does in the immune system, it makes sense that it would be important. But that's not a short answer. So I'm going to stop with that and not talk about major histocompatibility complex stuff. But I think that the chances of other variants being linked with disease is very high.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you guys have any questions on that side of the room?
Here we go.
Since you just took a long road trip, can you share with us your paleo snacks or how hard it was to eat on the road?
Yeah, we packed everything.
Meaning you.
Meaning I am the cook in my house and the shopper. So, yes, I packed everything. We didn't.
To be fair, the husband did the dishes.
Yes. My husband does. This has been our arrangement for nearly 22 years. I cook, he does the dishes. It works out well. I like cooking, and I would rather scrub toilets than do dishes. That's how much I enjoy doing dishes. So, we didn't even try to eat on the road, but that was because it was such a long trip and we were really worried about the time constraints. So what we did was we packed, our lunch was a picnic lunch. The kids like hot dogs straight out of the package. So I have this benefit. So I had, I found grass-fed, organic, uncured beef hot dogs at Walmart. And they were on like super sale because apparently nobody knows about these yet. So they were like regular, the organic ones were regular $5 a package, but they were on sale for $3.50. So compare that to $9 for the Applegate Farms one at Whole Foods. I was really excited about this. So they had those. I had some canned salmon mix for myself because I'm in a canned salmon phase. My husband had actually some leftover just cooked salmon. I was like, oh, that's got to go in here too. We had a huge baggie of I cut up carrot, celery, and cucumber. We had apples. We had some potato chips, some Boulder Canyon ones that are done in olive or avocado oil.
You said it.
I said it for you. We had epic snack strips for snacks in the car. I had rice crackers for my kids for snacks in the car. I had Powerballs for snacks in the car. I had some 85% chocolate that we didn't end up opening, but it was like, if we really need this boost of something, for driving. We had water to drink. And then for what I had made for dinner was like a stew. And I had had a little like hot plate warmy thing. It was really designed for a one serving. So we figured out after 2 hours and our stew was like lukewarm. I was like, oh, you need to, when it says 2 hours, they mean for one serving, and we should have really put it in about 4 hours earlier. But because my car has a regular plug, so we're able to just plug that in. It was still nice to have something warm on the road.
We've done rotisserie chicken, either like stopping at Walmart's, it's not the best ingredients, or you can even do like Whole Foods, or if you pack it and put it in a cooler, like the Trader Joe's clean chicken strips, you can, you know, just eat out of the package. That's what we usually eat on the road because it's easy to give the kids all a leg, and it can be cold, it can be room temperature. We have to get two chickens because there's that many boys. Right. Like, there's three boys and two legs.
Well, even with my two girls, we've done a lot of road trips where there have been two chickens in the road trip. Yeah. In my cooler. So,
as the driver, I literally tear off the breast and I'm just like...
And one of the things we're talking about on the way back is maybe finding a burger place. You know, it might be hard to find grass-fed burger places, but, you know, there's a lot of burger joints now that can handle gluten-free really, really well, and they know how to clean the grill, and we can do a lettuce wrap. The kids can have a gluten-free bun. It would be fine. So we're sort of talking about that versus, like, go out to Whole Foods or something the night before and get a rotisserie chicken. So those are, we still haven't figured that out. But, you know, I pack a cooler that's in the trunk, and I have a snack bag that sits between the kids. And it's, you know, it's all the same portable foods that we use at home. I always try to make sure there's protein in there because that's one of the things that evens out everybody's mood in the car because we all get really grumpy. And my kids have discovered the Epic snack strips and they love them. And that's really the only jerky like or meat snack that they really willingly eat. And then I always have raw vegetables and I always have fruit. Like those are standard. And then I always have something sweet because when we're all cranky and miserable, having a sweet treat, and we had Powerballs for, having a sweet treat, just, it's like, everyone goes like, oh, road trips are extra fun because we're going to get some kind of junk food, right? So, and yes, we call those junk food. It's fine. I also had, my oldest back there really likes Clif Kit bars, which are like Lara bars. So I had some of those for her, and I had raisins for my youngest, who that's her equivalent of, you know, sweet thing that I get to nibble on. But yeah, and I packed enough food for about 20 people. Yes, the other thing that I did.
Yep. Finn is actively eating out of a snack bag much of those same foods. The only thing I would add is my kids really like the strips. So like Chomp beef strips are like Slim Jims almost. And then we like the Rome pork sticks. So those two my boys love. And the Epic Bites. We don't like the bars, like the texture, especially if it's like sitting lukewarm in the car, can sometimes have like a weird mouth feel. But they really like the Epic Bites, which are like the liver bites were the original kind of bites, and now they've got like a bajillion delicious.
My kids find the bites too chewy. The snack strips are like 8 bites linked together, but they're slightly softer, but not as soft as the bars. So that's their like sweet spot. I like
each
the bars,
their own.
But yeah.
Thank you.
Was not a quick answer. She forgot that it was supposed to be rapid fire.
It's because I packed a lot of food.
Yeah.
I was just listing it all off.
Did you guys have any questions back there before we wrap up?
I'm here.
He's calling on you.
I would like to know if either of you would use a water filter in your house, or if you use one, why?
Matt will answer this for me.
Well, you got to repeat the question because that might not work.
So she asked if we use a water filter, and if so, which, and if not, why, essentially.
Do you want me to say my thing?
Sure. Matt feels really strongly about this, and then Sarah can give you the other side of the coin because I know she doesn't feel the same way.
Tap water is one of the greatest inventions of mankind. The fact that we have potable water that is delivered to our house for cheap at any time we want is great and fantastic. And it goes through so much process to get it to potability in your pipes, in your house. Like, I really feel like honoring our water engineers.
He really genuinely, like, feels emotionally attached
I feel really, really strongly about, like, how awesome tap water
is. So how marriage works is when one person feels more strongly about something than the other, then the other just is like, if it's that important to you.
Pick your battles.
That said, we did have, you know, a fridge that had, you know, a filter in it and, you know, a spout on it, and Stacy would drink from there, and I would.
But
drink
we're
from
not
the tap.
Burking the cat water.
I agree with that statement, but I also a large number of the members of my family have chloramine sensitivity, and chloramine is added to kill. That's the chlorine that's in water. Is the chemical they actually add is chloramine. And it made my brother extremely ill. He missed nearly an entire year of school in high school, which was how we discovered the sensitivity across many of my family members. So I have always used at least a Brita filter to remove, that removes most of the chlorine and fluoride. And my municipal water is Dasani, so I figure if I put it through a Brita, I've got Dasani. That's pretty much... You know, the Dasani plant's just down the road, so I figure, there we go. I've got super expensive water if I just put it through a charcoal filter. I recently won a $350 reverse osmosis filter, and I did set it up, and I have been using it. I feel like I have to add so much minerals back into it. So one of the things that I don't think we realize generally, sorry, it's not a short answer anymore, is how much mineral content came in the prehistoric diet from water sources. And even the water processing that happens to get the water into our taps, that water is not as mineral rich as the water sources that people would have consumed until really only the last couple hundred years. So I think that a lot of our mineral deficiencies can be fixed with remineralizing our tap water. So I use trace minerals and also another mineral drop that's name I can't remember. I think it's called EM drops. I add it to their water as well. So I feel quite strongly that, you know, this is mostly adding magnesium, calcium, potassium, and then some trace minerals, right? Those are things that we tend to be deficient in within the paleo diet even. So I think that's, you know, it's probably adding up to 20% of their RDA is coming from water now. And it's, you add enough that it, you know, it's not, you're not drinking like salty, disgusting water. Like it's, you're only adding a few drops to a large amount of water. So would I have gone out and bought a reverse osmosis water filter? No, I would have stuck with my cheapo carbon. And that really comes from my family's history of sensitivity. I think, you know, I come from a socialist country where we trust our government to look after us. We trust our government to do things like water testing and not tell us if there's lead in our water. That is not necessarily the American experience. So I think there's that extra little piece of, you know, knowing where the water's coming from, knowing the history, paying attention to those sorts of things. The big centers don't have issues in America the way small towns do. But, you know, Flint, Michigan is hardly the only town in this country with contaminated water to the point of being toxic and killing people. So with the extra little bit of, see how I'm becoming American here? With my, like, for the extra little bit of, you know, you want to make sure that your municipal water is properly treated and you don't have issues with, you know, lead or other heavy metals from your pipes. With that extra little addition, I think that the tap water is perfectly fine.
I do want to add that my when I was growing up, I grew up in Massachusetts, and in Massachusetts, it was very hit and miss with well water and municipal water, right? So our dentist, because he assumed everyone had well water, was prescribing everybody fluoride drops every time they say, you know, fluoride drops, put it in your water, like whatever. And we had, you know, municipal water, which was fluoridated. And so both me and my late brother Andrew had stained teeth, essentially from over fluoridation. So, you know, it's just a matter of knowing what's in your water.
Yeah.
But your water's probably okay. I mean, particularly in Fairfax County, Arlington County, Alexandria County, your water's probably going to be okay.
What's interesting about fluoridated water is that it's very unlikely to be causing any kind of health problems, but the science has not really shown that it improves dental health. Fluoridated toothpaste, there's really compelling science showing that that improves dental health and reduces cavities. But the idea behind fluoridated water, it hasn't translated. So whether or not it's worth going out of your way to take the fluoride out, there's some science to show that fluoride may sequester in the pineal gland and over 60, 70, 80 years maybe decrease the amount of melatonin that your pineal gland can secrete, and that might be linked with some sleep disturbances in the elderly, but it's very, very, like, that's kind of like if A leads to B, maybe G leads to H. There's a lot of steps in between that there hasn't been any science to figure out. But that's going to get out of your tap with a normal carbon filter. You don't need to go crazy town to get that out if that's something that you might be concerned about.
Okay. Well, thanks everybody for coming out. I just want to wrap up what I know we've said a couple times, but this is your community, so please
exchange phone numbers.
Meet people who are here. It's so magical and special that you joined us for this, because as Sarah and I have said, 5 years of weekly podcasting has not been for the two of us. It's been for the community and for the experiences that we've had meeting all of our listeners, both independently and together at signings and stuff like that. So thank you so much for coming out, and I hope that this was a fun experience. I would love to talk with you all and find out where you live and make sure that you connect with one another, because it's so awesome to see local people coming together, and not just, you know, for us, but for your own betterment and your own health and your own healing and that kind of stuff. So thanks for coming out.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
So what did you think of our first live podcast?
I think you talk a lot.
You haven't noticed that?
No, you asked me. I'm going to answer. Of course I know that.
I was going to say, I don't think that's different.
No,
than
it's absolutely not different at all.
That's fine.
Yeah, eye contact with the live audience and not me, so it was fine.
I tried. Yeah. I was looking at you when you were talking, but you were making eye contact with someone else.
Exactly.
So it wasn't awkward, I don't think. It's awkward right now.
It's definitely awkward.
I can tell you are just feeling like this is too much.
So awkward.
Well, I enjoyed this.
Excellent.
Thanks, everyone.
And thanks, Sarah, for coming up.
Yeah, now I just have to drive home.
If you need me to drop you off, I love car rides.
Yeah. What you need is a Matt in the family. But he does not like filtered water.
It's okay. We have water that comes out of our taps at home.
You pay for your water?
We do. And it's almost Dasani.